The 2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 353, Set Apart and Silenced, One Family Story of Excommunication and the Struggle to Heal. Papers presented by Marianne Luke, Lisa Scheid, Beth Luke, and a response by Mary Beth Rains.
I'd like to welcome you to this session of Sunstone, session number 353, Set Apart and Silenced, One Family's Story of Excommunication and the Struggle to Heal. Marianne Luke, our first presenter here, is my neighbor. We met her last year at Sunstone after living beside her for, a year and a half or something. Marianne had written an essay when she came to our writers group in our home, and it was so powerful. My husband knew the right thing to do, which was to suggest that she present it here today. And I'm so happy that she's doing that. Marianne's sister, Lisa Scheid, is, I guess, responding in a way, or adding to that. And Beth Luke, their mother, is also contributing to this more complete family story picture that we're getting here today. I am very touched by their story, and I think you will be as well. And we have the privilege also of having Mary Beth Rains respond. I'm so looking forward to this. It's been one of the highlights of this session for me. Looking forward to this. I know it will be wonderful. We'll start with Marianne. Are we going in the order that you're sitting? Okay.
I want to thank you all for being here and listening to our story. After Thursday evening meeting, in which the September 6th spoke so eloquently about their life post-excommunication, we wondered out loud what we could possibly add that hadn't already been said. And we decided that we would just be a quiet echo to their voices. A tiny, tiny, quiet, squeaky echo. We are their country cousins. If the Mormon Church is a microcosm of the world, then Kingston, Utah is a microcosm of the church. We are not here to influence anyone to our brand of truth. We only are here for two reasons. The first is to break the bond of silence. Because as long as we allow that to stand, the abuse continues for us. The second reason is to voice and own our truth. My truth is between me and my God. And no one, regardless of position or power, has the right to silence me. We are simple people. We have no aspirations to write a book or go on Dateline. In fact, I think that we would unanimously say that we value our anonymity. For us to speak to you today is a giant step, but I believe a necessary one in order to move forward. There is a country song that sums up our story. It goes like this. An itty-bitty house and an itty-bitty dog, an itty-bitty girl in an itty-bitty yard. It's all right to be itty-bitty. A little old house in a great big city. Might as well laugh, might as well smile. Life goes on for an itty-bitty while. Our country song would go like this. An itty-bitty family in an itty-bitty town, an itty-bitty bishop, and an itty-bitty teeny-weeny tiny-whiny stake president. E-I-E-I-O. So this is our itty-bitty story. I don't remember when I became aware that I was female. Maybe when I was six and became involved in a game of kissing tag. I never chased. I would never do that. So somehow I knew that to be an aggressive girl was forbidden. It was pulsing hot fun, and I was fast, and I knew how to avoid. I would run for safety in the girls' bathroom and huddle giggling in the corner. But secretly, I knew I was terrified of ever being caught. I remember Mom wearing an apron and being tired, always tired. She never said much as she pushed throughout the day. Mom never knew how to ask for help, not even from her 9 children. Her day was endless and weary-worn. She mostly worked in silence. Once we had gathered for dinner and no one liked what was prepared and we complained, and I remember her eyes tearing up and her saying that she was tired of being unappreciated. Mom was quite practical with money. She was the one that had to stretch the few pennies to buy material so she could make children's clothes. Sometimes she would cut down larger dresses for the smaller children, but mostly she went without so her children could have. I think I learned from Mom that to be a woman meant you were without everything, without power, without personality, without money, without time, without personal opinions. I think I internalized this belief and said, I don't ever want to be a woman. I remember Mom talking in hushed tones and about how Dad had once had a nervous breakdown, although I never quite knew what that meant. One day, my sister confided that she had found Dad's medical records in the county courthouse where she had a summer job. I visited her the next day, and we read through the file. My head feels like it's stuffed with cotton was the only quotation I remember. And I remember wondering what that felt like. Could he not think clearly? I thought cotton was soft and comforting. But maybe this cotton was unprocessed with seeds and sharp corners making it painful. Maybe this cotton clouded logic and made things blurry, confusing like a thick fog. Maybe this cotton was like the cotton used to stuff abscessed wounds and absorb blood and pus. It was also noted that he was suicidal. Later, when I had entered college, I had begun volunteering at the VA Medical Center, and I remember an aide discussing how every day he pulled patients out of closets and forced them to submit to their daily shock treatments. And I remember a sinking, sad feeling and thinking that that could very well have been my father. I adored my father. He made any conversation lively. He had an uncanny ability to bring all conversations back to one topic, the government, and how it was controlled by a secret combination, and later how the church had gone astray. One day, the children decided to test this theory to see if he could make Mickey Mouse somehow relate to the government. And he did. He made it relate. And to my father, everything was connected to the government, even Disney characters. Conversation in our small community consisted of weather, farming, and basketball. All aspects of the community were blended. We heard about weather, farming, and basketball at church, and church followed you to school as well. Somehow everyone knew who attended services that week, what positions in the ward you held. People were of one mind, not because they were united, but because they were afraid to express individual thoughts. All conversations had to be safe and controlled. The community viewed my father as a radical. However, whenever he brought up his political views, he was greeted with a silent wall of disapproval. He began examining the church. And when he dared to challenge the authority, he had broken an unspoken code of ethics. I remember my father only speaking to a few close friends about his beliefs. When my parents I remember my parents saying that they had been summoned to the bishop's court for excommunication. Dad felt that the leaders had made up their minds, so my parents chose not to go. And so the jury pronounced my parents guilty of what? I'm not certain. Were they guilty of having an opinion? Were they guilty of lacking a testimony in the dogma of the church? They were guilty of criticizing the authorities and voicing that opinion. The leadership of the church decreed that they did not belong, and my parents were officially deleted from the membership. In my mind, the church was equivalent to God. I saw my parents as spiritual people who loved God, and yet the spokesperson of God had decreed them unfit, apostate, and not to be associated with. The result for me was feelings of confusion and pain. If they kicked out my father because he dared to question, and kicked out my mother because she was his wife, then I was guilty by association. Such an event caused shockwaves throughout their community, and they reacted by withdrawing. As a teenager, I internalized this to mean I was flawed. I wasn't worthy. I didn't belong. My life now is about recovery, about peeling layer after layer, revealing loss, hurt, anger, despair, and finally, awareness and strength. Each new layer reveals the same intensity of feelings and emotions as the first. To the outside observer, it may appear as though I'm on a treadmill, hashing and rehashing the same theme. But internally, I know I am different. The colors change and the viewpoints change. I once asked a counselor why this theme keeps popping up, and she compared it to a spiral staircase circling ever upward. The center may appear the same, but the awareness changes. At times, it feels not like a staircase, but like a tornado ripping and tearing, creating confusion and havoc inside. I used to believe in absolutes, and now I know that nothing is solid. The challenge for me is to be as objective as possible. Sometimes I achieve this, but often I question myself. I realize that the filter through which I view the church may be cloudy. I also realize that my perception is based on my reality and past experiences, and while it is valid to me, it may not fit everyone. Whenever I spiral an issue, my identity becomes clouded and confused. A year ago, I wrote, "All my life, I've allowed my community, the church, to define who I am. Many of these messages have been negative. I believed that a woman was not defined by who she was, but by whom she was with. The man defined the woman. And yet through college, I was terrified of men. I never progressed much beyond the level of kissing tag. If someone kissed you, then it was time to run. And now I'm tired of running because I no longer know what I'm running away from. Now I look at myself and wonder, so what is a woman? What is this woman? And I really don't know. When you peel away all the layers, what then defines you? Can I let go of all the pain and sadness? And if I do, what am I in my nakedness?" It's an unanswered question. When I wrote this, I had come to an awareness of how deeply the culture of the church had affected my concept of who I am as a woman. The church defines woman by a specific role, that of wife and mother. Then, am I a eunuch? As a single woman, I am an anomaly, a ghost, a conundrum. By defining what is a woman, the church takes away my freedom to choose what woman means to me. The Mormon woman wears a sweet smile and carries the weight of the world willingly on her gingham-checked shoulders. She is everything to everyone except herself. And while I appreciate motherhood, I want to hear the realities of it. I want any role a woman chooses to be okay. Motherhood, single, divorced, it should not matter. I never wanted to be mainstream Mormon. because I never wanted to be as narrow-minded or judgmental as I believe Mormons to be. Being single has allowed me to stay on the fringe of the institution, a comfortable place. But being single has also forced me to remain on the fringe, where there are fewer people like me. This creates a sense of isolation, dragging forth the buried feelings experienced during the excommunication. I believe that the bishop and stake president were protecting the integrity of the church. Excommunication because of apostasy is not done out of love for the individual. It is done out of fear and protection against further apostasy, protection of their own reality. They say that it is done for the individual, for love of the individual, but I can tell you it doesn't feel like love. If this is love, I don't want to experience love. Excommunication serves the church because it keeps people in line. It is a form of discipline, like expulsion from school or being fired from a job. It is done for the benefit of the church to ensure conformity. I was afraid of Mormon men. I was afraid they couldn't accept my past. I knew that I wasn't solid in my own identity, and I was afraid of losing myself in a marriage. My stereotype of a Mormon marriage was of a woman lost in service to her children and community and lost to herself along the way. I saw the role of woman as submissive. Mormon men carried the stigma of the priesthood, and in my mind, the priesthood was a tool used to dominate and control. The priesthood was to be feared. Have you ever wondered why they set you apart to receive the priesthood? Is it interesting how words betray the motive? What are they setting men apart from? Women? Other men? Other religions? What if they set you connected to other people and other religions? Doesn't setting yourself apart give you power? Leaders suggest that priesthood gives men power. Why not empower everyone? Why does the church, why do men need to set themselves apart? I transferred my notion of men, authority, and fear to God as well. God was unapproachable, harsh, and judgmental. I would pray to him, but I always felt I wasn't worthy or even loved by him. He was distant, aloof, powerful, and very displeased with me. I am beginning to see the hand God has played in my recovery. He has placed certain people in my life, led me to books, helped me find workshops. He has become my friend, someone who assists. He's like a big concierge in the sky. I say, okay, God, I have an issue. Where do I go for help for this? I realize that my relationship needs further development, but at least it's a huge improvement over where it's been. The final level that I wish to discuss is the pain of being silenced. I came to believe that having and voicing beliefs was dangerous. When I walked into a church meeting, I became silent. At first, I believed that what I needed to do was to heal my wound, that once I let go of all the pain, I would feel at peace in the church and see things their way. This sent me on a path of self-exploration, and healing did occur. As I progressed, I became more clear what my beliefs were. I went to church to hear validation of my beliefs. The problem was that my beliefs became more divergent from the church. And as that happened, the more angry and frustrated I would become because my beliefs were not validated there. I was searching to find my truth, but when I walked into the church, I was expected to internalize someone else's notion of truth. One day I asked myself why my viewpoint was less valid than the leadership of the church's viewpoint, and I couldn't find an answer. The fact is, to me, my opinion is most valid. That doesn't mean I shouldn't listen or consider, but the notion to never question leadership now seems absurd. I have no desire to repeat my parents' path of excommunication. But I learned a valuable lesson from my parents, and that is to be true to my truth, regardless of circumstances. To be silenced or To deny my truth stops my progression. Truth comes from inside of me, not from a leader or a doctrine. Either a principle makes sense to my reality or it doesn't. What I believe in often lies on the subconscious level. I came to realize that when my emotions surfaced as a communication, when I would become upset at church, it was because I was trying to force the dogma of the church into my reality, and the two were at war internally. I believed that it was because I was wounded or flawed. Now, I realize that my feelings were trying to tell me something. The excommunication has become the defining event of my life. It is the silent eye of the storm from which most issues originate. Someone once told me that fear stood for false evidence appearing real. I look at my past beliefs and how each erroneous belief has led me to where I am today. Truth reveals itself so slowly. Perhaps it waits for me to evolve to a place where I can accept it. It is tempting to regret time spent in anger or fear, but this is part of the path. Can you find the lake if you don't first hike the mountain? I only hope that I'm progressing toward more awareness. I don't know where this stairway will lead. Perhaps it circles forever. Maybe it's not about arriving. Maybe it's simply about moving forward. Thank you. Hi. My sister Marianne encouraged me to begin writing my thoughts to help me work through my issues. So I'm going to begin with the first piece I wrote and end with the last piece and leave everything in between out. I'll begin with my poem, my first piece. It's called The Dagger. There is a dagger in my heart. It oozes pus and sometimes bleed. I can't find the handle to pull it out. It is buried too deep. Sometimes I wonder if I even want to pull it out. It protects me and reminds me of the dangers that are there. I was stabbed in my village as a young girl. We were assaulted. We had no shields. Darts and arrows were thrown. They pierced me. Someone with power and control threw the dagger. It plunged deep into my heart. When I re-enter the battle scene, the wound oozes and bleeds. I can feel the blood and pus draining from my body, and I feel weak. Oh, how do I remove this dagger? Do I even want to? I can't pull it out. I do not think even God can. It would take a village to remove it, and they do not exist. I have tried to find them, but they are not here. There is no one. The village is empty figures, still and lifeless. So I go where my wound does not bleed and I cannot feel the dagger. And now my last piece. My heart was broken when my parents were excommunicated. My life consisted of the church and my family. Church was a safe place for me. I believed everything I heard unquestioningly. I defended the church. I trusted it. I owned it. The excommunication has made me realize that it has owned me. First, let me explain my perspective at age 12. My parents were and are great people. My father taught us the importance of honesty and integrity and following our hearts. He had all those qualities. When our dog joined a pack of dogs killing our neighbor's sheep, my father paid double for the sheep. Dad always told us honesty is the best policy. He would reinforce this idea with stories of how his mother taught him to obey the commandments. He did what he believed in. He was a big advocate for truth and did not care what others said. My mother was the spiritual side of the family. I recall times I would need her, and after looking for her, I would spot her coming down the hill from behind our house. I soon learned that this was the quiet, contemplative place for her to pray. She always read the scriptures and tried to read them to us, but much to her frustration, we were not good listeners. A few months prior to the excommunication, Mom and Dad ceased to attend church. Dad found it too difficult, and Mom supported him, but my siblings and I went. Dad never spoke of his beliefs in church, and Mom only spoke about these things with Dad. I cannot remember the day or time Mom and Dad told us they had been excommunicated. I only remember the shock and betrayal I felt. The excommunication made me look into my heart and ask, is God with my parents or is He with the church? I felt strongly that the excommunication was not from God. I knew it was not recorded in heaven. Even so, attending church was brutal. My siblings and I would go together to the newly consolidated ward, which joined our old familiar ward with a nearby town. It was gut-wrenching to walk into that chapel and sit down. I felt so conspicuous. I would go the entire service without speaking to an adult. They had no words of comfort or support. This made it all the more painful. All that time, I thought we were regarded on the same level as the town drunk, and they did not want to be tarnished with our presence. Now I realize that they were just afraid and maybe oblivious to the tremendous impact the excommunication and their actions were on me. I quickly came to realize that the only reason I went to church was because I wanted to feel accepted amongst my friends, and I began to wonder if they went for the same reasons too. Within the year after the excommunication, I began to notice comments or activities that did not seem to have the right spirit. One day in Young Women's, a priesthood holder came to talk to my class. He told us that God kept a record of our church attendance and we must attend regularly if we wanted to make it to heaven. I knew this was not right and it disturbed me. I raised my hand and said very plainly, I think you are wrong. He looked astonished at me and then said he wanted to speak to me after class. I cannot remember what he said or how he spoke to me, but I do recall the pressure was too great and I began to cry. I would now say to him that church is a tool to further our spirituality, not a ladder to heaven. School was not as painful, but not easy. I felt more like a non-Mormon. Like most high schools, this school centered on being popular. I was not popular, nor did I care. I preferred blending in with the crowd. We were not treated fairly at times. Some teachers would give me the same grade regardless of my performance. A time or two, the popular students would say cruel things to me. Most of the time, no one spoke to me. I felt like a nobody. Inside, I felt defiant, but was silent and stayed with the few friends who accepted me. Leaving that area was like getting out of prison. My social life was a whole new experience of freedom. I recall my first job in Salt Lake City. A fellow employee began talking to me. I was shocked, thinking, "Don't you know who you're talking to?" My sister told me she experienced the same thing. Through college, church was something to do on Sunday. I was relieved to feel anonymous. I was not very religiously involved. Religion was the organization and the people, and spirituality had to do with my relationship with God. I was spiritual. I made friends with Mormons and non-Mormons, and I dated both. Deep down, I knew I didn't relate to the Mormon boys. They had a dedication to the church that I no longer possessed, and I was not comfortable with this. I began to date a non-Mormon. I struggled, knowing that the church's stand was to marry within the faith. My heart felt that this relationship was good, but the church said it was wrong. I had numerous questions about our relationship and prayed. I was always amazed with the swift response, as though this union was meant to be. I ended up marrying him, and he is the best thing that has happened to me. I have come to terms with being married to a non-Mormon, and it no longer troubles me. We have three beautiful children. I had the first two blessed, along with the Mormon tradition. My last baby was not blessed. I hit a brick wall. I did not want someone who was not part of my baby's daily life to say some arbitrary words over him. I wanted these words to be mine. I bought a journal for my baby and I wrote my own blessing. And one day, while he was sleeping, I read it to him. Last month, my daughter was baptized. I told her that this was her decision, and I would support her in what she did. As she stepped into the font, an ugly flood of emotions rushed through me. I tried to define them, but do not understand why they were there. I knew it had to do with the past. I can see that as a result of the excommunication, I lost trust of the members, especially the leaders. Trust is a crucial component of a healthy relationship, and that was severed. I still struggle with trusting members, but I have worked on reaching out to them instead of waiting for them to come to me. The bishop that was part of the excommunication was and still is a difficult person for me. I used to struggle with all persons in leadership or authority roles, bishop, relief society presidents, bosses, supervisors, and professors petrified me. I know that this was a direct result of the excommunication. I no longer trusted people in positions of power. Finally, with age and experience, I do not feel that discomfort. Instead, I recognize the burden of their jobs. I have tried to find a place of comfort in my heart at church, but it does not speak to my heart. I value my spirituality, and I cling to the core principles of the gospel that ring true to me. The excommunication destroyed my love for the church. For years, I would feel guilty about this and believe that God was unhappy with me because I had no motivation to embrace the church. Now I have let go of trying to love the church and work on my love for our Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ through prayer and meditation. I am learning that God is about unconditional love, and not His love is not conditional. He may not approve of our behavior, but He knows why we do the things we do, even when we do not. He does not reject us, only our behavior. He wants to help us understand our problems and work through them. I do not see the church working to help us through our problems. I see them expecting me to join them and adhere to their philosophy, which I compare to a beehive. The beehive philosophy means working to support the church. If a member is not productive, other members work to make them productive. This philosophy does not embrace the individual or empower them. The excommunication made me more aware of individual feelings and ideas and how we all have a need to feel like an individual and empowered. I do not feel like an individual or empowered at church. I feel like an outsider and powerless. I experience situations that feed these feelings. One issue that attacked my individuality is in the temple interview, it is asked if you associate with apostate groups. I wonder what their definition of an apostate group is, and if I were being interviewed, what would the bishop say when I said, yes, I grew up in one? I feel powerless when members say you must be careful what you read, but I think, what about learning to become discerning and gaining from others' knowledge and experience? I really feel a loss of empowerment when I hear instruction to uphold leaders, even if they do no wrong, saying, God will bless you for it. I see members fervently trying to do this. My dad often said, if church leaders told members to go down to the corral and get a bowl of manure, pour on a little cream and sugar and eat it, they would do it. This pressure to follow the leaders and not question their words or action is in direct contrast with how, as members, we can easily acknowledge compassion. I'm going to start that over. This pressure to follow the leaders and not question their words or action is in direct contrast with how, as members, we can easily acknowledge losing my place. We can easily acknowledge with compassion and weakness the faults of Jesus' disciples and Moses' mistakes, yet turn around and allow leaders to do wrong or push wrong ideas, and we are all silent. Excommunications send the message that questioning will lead to expulsion, which adds more pressure to conform silently. This is a small sampling of questions I have that creates a feeling of being gagged and bound at church. I have tried to conform to these beliefs, but this experience, the excommunication, is leading me in another direction. Maybe God wanted this to happen to us to open our eyes to the truth. I know my mind has been seriously altered by this experience, and I am slowly realizing it is a blessing. Thank you.
I don't know how I can follow my daughters and do it justice, but I will try. I'm very deeply touched by my daughters' stories of isolation and pain, how their very foundations were shaken by the unjust action of the men in authority in our community. I never realized how much they hurt until the past 3 years since my husband passed away, and we've spent more time together and talked about our pain and searched for answers. During the excommunication years, I was able to isolate, but my children were not. The ones in local schools were hurt the most. The older ones had left home and were in college and working. They are still active in the church. At present, I have 2 grandsons in the mission field and 2 grandchildren who have completed missions. I am like my daughter, struggling to understand where the truth really is. We study, consider, and pray, and talk to each other a lot. We love the scriptures and consider the truths of other cultures, too. We believe in Joseph Smith and the truths he brought forth. I believe we are making progress. In 1988, our youngest son desired to fill a mission. He urged us to be baptized before he left. He believed we were true to gospel principles and felt we could help him this way. We fasted and prayed about it, and I realized to support Sam spiritually was the most important thing I could do. My husband was very ill at the time, and because of this, the decision fell on my shoulders. So we were baptized again. But still, we couldn't attend church very often because it stressed Daryl too much. And I had to be with him continually. So my church activity began after his death 3 years ago. During my time not attending church, I read a lot to pass the time. It was very liberating. Now I identify with a lot of people. I view the church as very restrictive and fearful of expanded ideas in many areas. I cannot be restricted now. I know too much of life. So I go to church, but I feel isolated and not understood in many ways. I can't share my knowledge because the church only approves certain things. I have surface friends in my valley, but none who know the core beliefs of my heart. Maybe that is the way life is as one ages. As far as I know, the incidences that possibly led to our excommunication dealt with our views on politics and our friends. In the 70s, we began to study government conspiracies and how the churches were becoming infiltrated with their people. We joined the John Birch Society for a while, and with 3 other families sent out some pamphlets of John Birch literature to people in the valley, until a survey revealed that they didn't appreciate receiving the pamphlets, and so we stopped. We became friends with a German couple who were converts. We shared the same beliefs about the government conspiracies. They knew the German boy who wrote pamphlets opposing Hitler, They knew he was excommunicated from the LDS Church before Hitler executed him. The church now has a film honoring him, and they reinstated him when Germany built a youth center in his honor. This is since the World War II. The German couple knew a lot of church history. They believed in polygamy, but were not practicing it. They had investigated the polygamous groups, but felt none of them were worthy of their allegiance. They were called to church court the same time we were. At their trial, they were told they could not appeal because the brethren in Salt Lake had sent word for them to be excommunicated. The brethren had been searching for them for a long time. But because they move frequently, they've been unable to catch them. This confirms the hit list for excommunication. Daryl and I never believed there was any authority for polygamy since the church had voted against it. So polygamy was not an issue for us. Five of our children filled honorable missions, and we supported them as much as we could. When our third son wanted to go on a mission, he and his dad were having some disagreements about the church ignoring the freedom issues. Our son took his grievances to the bishop and stake president, and they helped him get his mission call. And he was on his mission when the church trial was held. Daryl was angry. The high council would doubt his integrity. He said, "We've done no wrong. We know the truth. They should be coming to us. They know where we live." He would not go to church court, and I did not go because of other reasons of a personal nature, that I felt certain they would question me on issues they had no right to question. If I could relive those days, I would go to the court and defend our membership. There was no serious breach on our part. I believe we needed understanding and not action at that time. I never read the letter explaining our excommunication. I guess Daryl thought he would spare me. I'm still trying to figure it out. The ghost of our excommunication still haunts me. I wish I could tell my ward the things I'm telling you. I wish they knew my daughter's pain. My daughters have told me that they are grateful. They realize how much control is exercised in the church. They are doing a lot to broaden their understanding and learn the true meaning of Christ's teachings. We are not bitter. Daryl was not bitter. He made a point to tell the stake president that he had no hard feelings about what had happened. The valley was split over our excommunication. We had supporters who felt it was very wrong. Some told me that was why the stake president moved soon after. My experience and study have taught me to listen to people and not condemn anyone for excommunication or an unjust trial. Thursday evening was liberating for me. I started to read Maxine Hank's book on women and authority. I really intend to read more of his and the other books of Thursday's panelists. I agree with Levina's article in Sunstone. In Sunstone, I have found a family I can relate to. The prophecies foretell of the inhabitants judging Zion. It is our duty to speak out, but so many are afraid to speak for fear of more condemnation. But how else can the pain be eased? Everyone has a different story, and if we talk about them, we can help each other. We are believers in the true gospel of our Lord. We love the Lord and will always seek His will. And I say this in Jesus' name. Amen.
I've noticed all of us responding with our heart as we've listened to the story of these three women and the tragedy they've lived through over the last decades. And even though you may not have been aware of it, there are many of you who have been nodding your heads at various places and at various intervals in the story and have been crying your own tears for what I'm sure is not just for them, but for your own pain that you have had in one situation or another, whether it was the church, whether it was from members of the church, or whether it was not related to the church at all, but that somehow within you a deep split and then a subsequent shunning had occurred that feels to be left outside of yourself or left outside of your community. One of the big questions, I think, are we able to recover? Can the human spirit go beyond what's happened to us? And I'd like to really acknowledge how I think these women have experienced what in Mormon circles is the worst, and how they have grown and how they've chosen a path of recovery. Certainly as a therapist, that's my question and concern on a daily basis as I work with people and as I've worked with tragedies and concerns in my own life. So as many of us are here today sitting in a community of people, even though we haven't looked at each other and said so, I would like to, a community of people who have had our own pain, I would like to have us, as I speak, think about our own stories and about what's happened to us and find if somehow within what I'm next to say, you might find the architecture of your own recovery. I'd like to speak to a number of steps, I think, that answers steps toward an answer of yes, that we can recover from our own story and from our own experience, and that our spirit and our spirit with God is much more healing than anything that can happen to us. One of the trauma that occurred to all of these people, as real as we felt about it, and particularly egregious, was that it occurred over a long period of time. One author noted that it's very hard to recover until the trauma stops. But in some circumstances, it never stops. It continues. As it in some ways is continuing for the Lukes. And so still we have to figure out how are the steps beyond that. The first thing that tends to happen during a trauma or even in the stages afterwards is that reverberating, the shock that comes again and again and again with dreams, with new events, with not being able to talk about it and not being able to understand it. Tolstoy, I believe, noted what happened in the hours and the days after a war scene or a war incident. He noticed that during the first few hours, the stories about what had happened were scrambled. People would only tell details one after another sequentially. But there was no cohesive story to the whole situation. It was just events after events after events. But within a few hours and maybe by nightfall, a story would start to shape after it, and much in the ways that we tell stories in our lives, that it has a beginning and a middle and end. There's a places where something happens, then we make meaning of it. Then there's crucial points and nodes of action occur, and then there's a conclusion somehow. And that within 24 hours, a great wealth of the details had dropped out, but the story had emerged as primary. And within a number of weeks or months, really there were just the outlines of the story, and the details were formed and shaped to fit that story, and that many of the first details were lost that did not fit that story. So it becomes crucial in that process of reverberating and happening to notice that we create our story about that, and what we create is crucial. And as I see the Luke family, they've created a story that says who we are and what we believe in, and our faith in God is there at the center regardless of what happens to us. And it's this kind of story, this way of witnessing to ourselves and then witnessing to others and speaking things, that is crucial to recovery and to transcending what happens to us. Those of us who create stories that keep us totally as at the mercy of what's happened to us have a harder time in the long run recovering. It is also important to speak that story again and again to other people and to get multiple reflections not just a reflection on whether we're accurate or not, but active support for the feelings, because the feelings are as important and as potent as our mind, and they need a new cradle to fit in to be able to be nurtured and grow beyond. Interestingly enough, the next stage is that we tend to then form important pieces of our identity around the events of what happened to us, and also to the story that we've created within ourselves and the community story within our family or with people that we're close to. That identity hopefully tells the story in a way that keeps the details accurate, but at the center of it also aligns mostly with what is our resiliency, what is our faith, what is our hope, and what coping skills that we're using in order to be able to continue to go the next step in life with as much heart and compassion as possible. And I noticed that the Lukes are doing this, and they have done it, and the next stage is already at the forefront, I hear, in their stories. And that is, we start to transcend our story. What's occurring to us now is more important than what has happened to us. I remember a client telling me one day several years ago that she had been through a number of tragedies in her life. But she said, I want to be able to grow to the point where what has happened to me is not the most important detail in my life. I want to know who I am. I want to know what I love doing. I want to know who I care about and who I'm connected to. I want that to be the story of my life. And so I see the transcendence of the story emerging, that all of these women, even though still having enormous questions, an enormous impact from what you've lived through time and again, who you are and how you've gone beyond that is really what is occurring, and I celebrate that with you. The next step beyond that, in terms of transcending our story, I should say an important part of transcending your story, is called by some people restorying. You break apart old pieces that maybe not fit or maybe need to be grown beyond, and you reassemble them much like a new collage. And they themselves over time are then woven into what's happening to you now. So it's really crucial in our process of working through what we've been through that we take the next step of really making a very good life. That we really learn that we are entitled to follow our joys and to follow our heart, to form relationships with people that we can care about and are cared about. And then that becomes the story of who we are. And so I applaud them for growing beyond, and I applaud all of us for sitting here and listening to them, because I believe at the core of that, we're growing beyond our own stories and we can always take it further. So in the answer to the question, can we grow beyond? I think we absolutely can. I recall listening to someone recently who was telling me about something that was going on in her life. And then she said, you know, an interesting thing happened to me the other day. Somebody was telling me about how they were raped. I listened to the whole story and I was finished. And it was only later that I realized and remembered I had been raped. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, all of you. That was pretty potent stuff. Kind of gets your gut stirred up, and I think, as Mary Beth said, it you know, even if we're not thinking consciously about our own tragedies or whatever, on a gut level, I think we relate that way. We have about 5 minutes left for questions and comments. Please, if anyone who does want to, come up to the front so that we can have them on the tape. Anyone?
Just a quick one. I do want to thank you for sharing your story. I identified a lot with some of the issues. The question I had after attending last year's Sunstone Symposium, one session brought up the idea of a Heavenly Mother, and I wondered if in your search of healing and trying to find if that was a factor, or if not, would you consider, I guess, maybe looking at the womanly goddess figure, yes, in helping to heal versus then the approval of Heavenly Father? So I was interested in that.
Absolutely. And for me, I needed to find a female god.
And now there are times when I pray only to her. So, yeah.
Well, when you're talking about your brother and how his response was a little bit different, and I'm interested to know if you felt any, how you differentiated yourself from your parents and their views, and if you felt a need at any point to go through a process of forgiveness or reconciliation with your parents, for if you felt any blame that you assigned to them for your condition that you went through.
Well, that's a really complex question with a lot of different angles to it. At first, right after the excommunication, of course, we really aligned ourselves with our parents and separated God out from the church. And so here was the church and here was God, and we went with our parents and with God. But yet, on the political issues that Mom and Dad would speak on and their conspiracy ideas, we didn't agree with them and would let them know so. And maybe still we are a little bit separate on that, don't quite see it like Mom does. But when it comes to the way we see the church, we have become more aligned. At first, Marianne and I, and even our brother, our younger brother, who wanted them to get baptized, he no longer goes to church and has huge issues with it, even though he wanted them to get baptized. We have grown more to see the church as something that doesn't work for us. It feels more like an institution and to itself, and it doesn't address us at all in many ways. No, he's not. Okay, I'll give you another little detail to the story because there's a lot that we haven't told. It would take too long. He also has schizophrenia. And with schizophrenia, they often become, they find religious issues to be troubling. And when I say religious, I mean the church, you know. He's spiritual, but he has a hard time with religion. The question was there any conclusion drawn from my father's hospital stay? Oh, the court papers, yeah. I found them in the courthouse, and I called Marianne, and she came over, and I even had Mom come over when nobody was there because I was afraid I'd get in trouble. And we read them over, and it actually gave the name schizophrenia, but it didn't define it. So then we, instead of just a nervous breakdown, we knew that Dad had schizophrenia. So, and that just played into everything. Oh, yeah, Mom said, we grew up not knowing that he had schizophrenia. You know, he had paranoid schizophrenia, so he had, if an airplane flew over our house, for example, quite low, he thought that they were spying on us. So, you know, because it was the government coming to get him. Yes. Okay, the question was there any lack of insight to our father's mental illness, and did that play into the excommunication? Oh, yeah, definitely.
They didn't realize he was ill. I think the ones who supported us did know that Dad was struggling, and that's the reason they supported us. But the leaders had no clue, and they wouldn't listen to anybody. They seemed to be so stubborn. Did that answer your question? Yes. Very good question. The question is it common to excommunicate the wife as well as the husband? You know, I don't have any knowledge on that because I'm not any kind of leadership pro and never been even close to it, but it seems to be. I've heard of other situations where they tell the husband or the wife they need to get out of that marriage or else they're going to be excommunicated. And if they don't, then they do get excommunicated. Yes? Yes?
Have members of your community or your hometown come back and be asked to apologize or accept some reconciliation with you or your family?
The question... Right. The question was, have any members of the community come back to apologize and reconciliate with myself or anyone else in the family? And absolutely not. It's like I said in my talk that I don't think they realize how it affected us and how ostracized we felt. And you know, they're kind of backwards. What can I say? Socially, they don't know how to behave.
Thank you so much for telling your story. We've been privileged to hear it. I just have one little thing I want to ask Marianne because it's something that she left out of her paper. That the town was, how big was the town?
It was 150 people.
And can you tell us, Marianne, how you know that?
In my previous paper, I said the town was 150 people, and I know that because one night Lisa and I counted everybody.
Stayed up and made a list of names. Thank you for your attendance here today, and thank you for all of our panelists.